Hi guys, and welcome to another episode of Radcast. This month, after much teasing, we are finally kicking off our fellowship series, and we have a great guest to get us underway in Dr. Flavius Pavulescu.
Now, Flavius is a first-year IR consultant at the Royal Liverpool Hospital, but prior to taking up his consultant post, he completed a prestigious year-long fellowship at Sunnybrook Hospital in Toronto. So we thought it would be a good opportunity to find out how he got on and hopefully help anyone who might be considering going down the same path in future.
So as a disclaimer, Flavius is actually the duty IR consultant of the week, or the cow as he prefers to be known. So he has warned us that there is a chance he'll get interrupted. Apologies if that does happen, but just take it as us giving you a real life IR experience.
Yeah, let's see if they're actually as busy as they say they are, eh? So Flavius, would you like to tell the listeners a bit about yourself?
Thank you guys. Thank you for inviting me. Not much to say other than what you've added. Just to say that I have completed the 6-year training in radiology, so I have a CCT in intervention. Mm-hmm. And the fellowship that you mentioned was followed that, so it was basically my 7th year.
And do you have a subspecialty interest in IR?
Very good question. I'm starting to wonder that myself. I think you'll discover... plans don't necessarily work out, or certainly they didn't for me, but in part because I didn't come in very determined to follow one path or the other. Mm-hmm. So there are, as you know, many IRs who are very much interested in just vascular intervention, or some that are not interested in that and only in other little bits. For me, it's I love interventional radiology with all my heart, and I love pretty much every aspect of it. So I'm happy to do everything. And at the moment, I'm a bit of a jack of all trades.
Master of none.
Well, there is that. So we can get to that.
Okay. So if you eventually do decide that you like one part of IR a bit more than everything else, would there be opportunities for you to go down that route and sub-specialize?
Yes, so there's definitely there's a trend to subspecialize, like it is, I suppose, in all of radiology. But this, I suppose, is in sub-specialize within a subspecialty. It depends a lot. My point actually is that it depends a lot on where you will be working and who you will be working with. So, for instance, when I left for Canada, I had plans to work in a department where I thought I'll be doing interventional oncology mostly, because at that time it was almost a one-man show and there was need for support. But when I returned, the landscape had changed a bit, and I ended up doing more vascular intervention than IO. So that's what I mean by, you know, plans. It depends. And also it depends whether you work in a tertiary hospital or whether you work in a smaller hospital, because clearly in a larger hospital there will be need for specialization in little small areas where you do complex procedures, whereas in a smaller hospital you probably need to be able to do less complex procedures but on a wide range, you know, from liver external iliac artery to whatever, subclavian vein to liver biopsy, you know.
So what was it that attracted you to IR in the first place?
So I'm one of those that decided, I think it's somewhere in 4th year in medical school, that I'm going to do interventional radiology.
Oh, wow.
So that I was pretty determined. It was a combination of liking anatomy, liking computers, and... I think that was most of it. And liking the idea, I think I really liked the idea that it was very cool. It was the new kid on the block in medicine. And I think in many ways it still is, isn't it? Mm. Compared to traditional surgery, it's a baby that only has, about 50 years of life. And it is, you know, those famous, maybe you've seen them on, I used to have one on my thyroid shield cover. The one with a unicorn that says interventional radiology, it's like surgery, only magic. It is in many ways like that, and it just occasionally a patient reminds us when we become a bit blasé. But you know, they go, hold on, so you're going to puncture my wrist and treat the cancer in my liver? And they look at you like, what are you on? Have you been smoking? And you go, yeah, actually, that is pretty cool now that you put it like that, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
So I think it's easy to fall in love with it. And then it's good for millennials. I strongly recommend it because it gives you instant gratification. You know, we all, you know, 4G and all that, we can't wait for a website to load more than 2.5 seconds and we go, oh. It's like that with intervention, you know, there's bleeding, you do your thing, there's no bleeding, patient's fine. Fistula is blocked, you do your thing, it's now running. So abscess, no more abscess, you know, it's very, very easy to reap the rewards.
Yeah. I think. So how was your IR training in the UK? Do you think that at the end of your CCT, you would have been ready to practice as a consultant here?
I think that's a very, very, very good question. And it will clearly differ a lot between trainees. And I remember asking this when I was close to finishing. I was asking somebody who was about a year or so ahead of me. And they answered very relaxed, oh yeah, I got this. You know, they were absolutely on top of it, not a shadow of doubt. And I was so envious, so jealous of them. I wasn't like that. I knew what I knew and I knew what I didn't. And I think I was concerned for my stress levels. If I was to be asked to do a, you know, an embolization on a dying patient at 3 o'clock in the morning the following month after finishing my CCT. Yeah. And also generally the you know, the decision making, the doing it on your own, not so much the actual procedural aspect, where I was fairly confident that I had enough experience and dexterity and stuff like that. So the actual technical doing bit. The two things where I felt I could use more experience was the decision making. So when to do what to do, and more importantly, when not to do. And also the little things that go behind the somewhat behind the scenes, you know, like the kind of administrative part of dealing with a patient or if not, but not necessarily administrative, but things that go unnoticed when you're so concentrated as a trainee. And if IR trainees are listening now and they're in their fourth year, maybe beginning of fifth, they will know what I mean. You know, you're so focused on the actual, you know, get the puncture right.
Yeah.
Don't mess that up. Don't rupture that. Don't dissect the other, you know, things like that. That when it comes to how long should we put this patient on aspirin or, you know, should we restart the warfarin or, you know, should we give them antibiotics before this procedure or, you know, those other clinical aspect that goes unnoticed and you, without realizing, often ask the consultant or it bypasses you completely. And then when you're suddenly the only person having to have all the answers, I think it is a big ask.
Yeah.
And I feel that my stress levels and my longevity on this world and preventing ACS has been made better by the fellowship.
So now those 3 a.m. embolizations don't bother you at all? You just like,
No, they do. I had one a couple of days ago, and a colleague who's slightly younger than me, also an even more junior consultant than me, asked if I needed a hand, although they weren't on call. Presumably thinking that my pride will get in the way and I'll say, no, I'm a big boy. But I said, yeah, definitely, please help. And it's always better to have a second pair of hands anyway, but also someone to bounce ideas off. So no, it's still stressful, but I certainly feel more comfortable with it than I did before Canada.
So when you were doing your IR training, did you ever face any issues with the turf war that we kind of hear a lot about? You know, did you feel as though you were competing with vascular trainees for theatre time?
I definitely did. And it's one of the reasons why to this day I don't do any aortic work, because I had colleagues telling me, you know, they just spent all day as the fourth in line holding a wire in a EVAR repair. And I made a decision, which I was going to, is probably the most important message that I would like to get across to anyone listening and thinking about this. I made a decision where I decided I want to finish my training and be able to get a job where if somebody asks me, okay, so what can you do? What can you help us with in our department?
Yeah.
If they said, you know, we don't have a TACE program, we don't do any interventional oncology, can you set that up for us? Where I could say, yes, actually, I can. Or, you know, you can replace TACE in non-interventional oncology with whatever, you know.
Yeah.
As opposed to, you know, can you do an EVAR on your own as a first operator with a registrar, fourth year registrar that is going to be an extra pair of hands but doesn't actually know anything? And if the answer is no, then you need to ask yourself, you know, what sort of consultant job you want to get and what can you bring to the department where you're going to be working? Are you going to be fully independent, able to support the service on your own? Or will you basically still need the guidance and support to do everything? Because you know some of everything, but nothing in great depth.
Right.
Which is why I know nothing about aortic work, but enough to work fully independent in other areas. And how I went for my fellowship.
So don't spread yourself too thinly. You have to be like a master at something.
That was my, that was my take on it.
Okay. So IR is becoming more and more popular every year. And in fact, this year within our deanery, there was a competitive entry for IR ST4, which you'll know very well because you were on the interview panel, I hear, playing bad cop. And I think there's a similar situation around the country. So do you welcome the increased popularity in IR?
Absolutely. There is a lot of demand and the field is ever growing. And actually, that's the other thing, you know, it kind of relates to what I was just discussing. There's a lot that interventional radiology covers in areas where you need a lot of experience to do a good job. Like, you know, there are things like AV malformations, for instance, which there are people who have done a lot of it. And you have to invest a lot of time in it to become good, to have good outcomes for patients. So I just don't think there are enough hours in the day to have an IR that does literally everything. Which I suppose goes the same for diagnostic imaging nowadays, isn't it? Because the complexity of the modalities has increased so much. So I do think there is a lot of demand for IRs so that they can subspecialize. As I said, I think it's a fantastically fun and rewarding specialty. And I'm glad to see that more trainees are interested. I'm not surprised. I am glad.
So do you think it's unfortunate that you're perhaps having to turn away good candidates now through the competitive recruitment, even though there's still a workforce shortage because there isn't the capacity to train them?
Yeah, it is very unfortunate, especially since for a while, at least during my training, we complained that there aren't enough of us. And you know, as you remember, I was the only ST6 in our deanery for a while. And I thought it's bad for me as well as for the departments that they can't choose. I think a bit of competition is very healthy and stimulates somebody to do better. I think I could have been better if I did have competition, but I was relaxed because, you know, they had to do with me, whether they liked it or not. There was nobody else around. I do understand. I think looking at the big picture, probably, you know, Department of Health levels, I suppose they have to pay for an extra year as training as a registrar. Yeah. I don't know how that works precisely, but I can kind of understand why you can't have unlimited numbers.
Yeah, it's always money that it comes down to ultimately.
It does. And the greater good, I suppose. And I mean, that's assuming somebody has a strategy, which is a different conversation, I think.
I feel like the cutoff has really been our year. So in our year, there were, I think, four people who wanted to do IR, or three people, and they all got to do it without any issues. And then suddenly the year below, it's like everyone's fighting each other for a few spots. So
it's, I think it's probably the case in other deaneries, though. Like one of my friends in Cambridge, who's a year ahead of us, so he's doing his ST6 now. he had to do competitive recruitment for IR internally.
Right. Okay.
So that's going back
yeah.
3 years.
I think, yes, you need to remember that the training, if you start in year four, does take 3 years. So probably that would explain why your colleagues, you know, have suffered because the year ahead of them occupied a few places.
Yeah, yeah.
It's still an IR training slot, isn't it?
Exactly.
What you're in. Yeah.
And coming back to your previous question, did you feel prepared at the end of training? If you have, throughout my training, I always had, until the very last few months, I always had somebody more senior than me in the department, you know. When I was ST5, there was an ST6 and stuff like that. So I always felt that I could have had more experience without them. Mm. So I was throwing banana peels everywhere to the department, just hoping. No, I'm joking. But seriously, you have to give trainees, give them opportunities. You have to allow them to do every complex case because they need that. They need that to be able to hit the ground running when they do finish. So you can't have too many people in a department because they will just, again, like I said, you know, each of them will end up at the end of the year having done two of these and two of that, but
yeah.
You can't go anywhere with two. You need 20. Mm.
Okay, so we'll move on to the main topic of the episode now, which is your fellowship. So why did you pick the one that you did specifically?
I went on the road that was ahead of me and that was well paved by previous colleagues, really. If you remember, at least in our deanery, I think every single year of the six that I trained for, there was one registrar who went to Canada for training.
Mm-hmm.
Now I know a bit more. They have a big tradition of these fellowships, and they have a system where they pretty much rely on, you know, how in the same way the NHS relies on SHOs and would collapse if you remove them tomorrow. It's the same way in Canada with international fellows.
Mm.
In fact, in Toronto alone, do you know how many radiology fellowships they have in every year?
Per hospital?
Or... No, throughout Toronto.
It would be a wild guess.
Yeah, absolutely no idea.
It would be wildly inaccurate. I'm going to say, yeah.
Go on.
500.
No. No, okay. Maybe not that. It's a very wild guess. No, they have 100, and that is huge.
That is loads.
Because that is just radiology, right? They and there are many, many specialties in. I think actually they have something like over 1,000 international fellows.
Right.
So there's the huge number, and it is very well organized, I think, because they've been doing it for so long and in such numbers. They're very well organized. I mean, it takes obviously a bit of Googling and finding out, but once you get to where you need to get, the process is well organized. There's clear, do this, tick that, apply by this date.
Mm.
And I liked that. And I will compare that with my other thought, which was Australia, because clearly I went for English-speaking places.
Mm-hmm.
And in Australia, you know, weather's better, money's better, but they were very much the opposite.
Right.
So they were kind of like, yeah, mate, yeah, sure, we'll talk later, no worries. And in all fairness, Canada is not near, but... Australia is, you need a lot of time to prepare and get your paperwork, and they didn't seem to mind that. And I know somebody who managed to do everything in something like 10 months, but they told me it was the most stressful time of their life.
Yeah.
Canada does everything with 2 years in advance, right?
Right.
So you have ample time to sort out everything.
Okay. So you applied in ST4 at the beginning of ST or at the end of ST4 would it have been?
Correct. Yeah. So it is precisely. So they start their fellowships in June, July, and their cutoff is literally 2 years ahead. So if you start on the 1st of July, like I did, the cutoff was the 30th of June, 2 years before. So I was in ST4. So you need to start halfway through your ST4, finding out, you know, whether you want to do it, whether you can, you know, your social circumstances, obviously family and all that is very important. And then, apply in kind of April, May. So if there are ST4s listening now, this is a good day to start finding out. Yeah.
So I imagine in the current climate, all of the interviews would have been done remotely, but did you have to travel to Canada for an interview?
I did. I can't remember now, actually, if it was an absolutely mandatory thing.
Right.
But certainly everyone I had spoken to said, if you want them to take you seriously, you have to go there. Because it is, they do realize it's 2 years in advance. So there is a probably not insignificant dropout rate.
Right.
Because, you know, people have kids or whatever in 2 years. 2 years is a long time for all sorts of things to happen in one's life. So I think they want to see commitment. And if you can't be bothered to take an 8-hour flight to come and see them, then maybe you don't want it that much. So, and because it's such a close working relationship, which we'll probably get to in a minute, and they rely on you so much, I think if you want, if you really want it, you should definitely, I recommend that you definitely go there. You need to see them, they need to see you, and I think your chances of success have automatically improved dramatically compared to a Skype interview or whatever, Zoom.
Do you know how what the competition was like in terms of how many people applied for the post?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not certain about the number of applications that they receive online. Somebody told me recently that there are probably hundreds in the, something like 800, which sounds a bit excessive, but I'm sure there is somewhere in the region of hundreds. I did ask, and they interviewed in my year, they interviewed about 60 candidates.
Okay, wow.
For 7 places across the city, because the system there is they have 3 main trusts, I suppose, as it were, Sunnybrook being one of them. And when you go to interview, you go and see all of them. So it's a very intense day where you have appointments with the consultants from every hospital. And once you finish with one hospital, you go to the next and then you go to the third. Sometimes it's spread over 2 days, but that's what it was like in my case. And then you speak to each and every one of them. And they score you. So out of those 60 people, let's say, they score everyone. And then they compare the scores that they obtained with whatever preference the candidate had. So you say, I want to go to this trust as opposed to, and my second choice is this one, and my third is that one.
Is there an order in terms of how prestigious they are and or most people's preference?
It definitely is in Toronto, for sure. I can't speak of any other place, but there is the so-called UHN, University Hospital Network, which actually covers about 5 different buildings and 5 different hospitals. And that's definitely, you know, l'ombelico del mondo. It's, I mean, I'm not saying that they don't deserve it. But yeah, that's where they do the cool things. They have the cool equipment and they're famous and they publish a lot. And, you know, that is the place to go.
Yeah.
And in fact, I remember when I went for the interview, there was a there was a guy, one of the fresh consultant staff, as they're called there. And he said, did you put on your application that you want Sunnybrook as your first choice? And I said, yes. And he, I can't remember exactly how he put it, but he was like, are you all right in the head? You know, like everyone wants to come here. Like we're to the top of the props. I don't know. Anyway,
egos, yeah.
Well, yeah, you'll find that everywhere. It's not specific to them. but yeah, so there is a prestige about it. And I would also recommend that people do not take that lightly. Because whether you think it's correct or not is irrelevant. The reality is life doesn't work like that. Prestige is very important in medicine, wherever you want to work. And I think the UK is an excellent example of that. So it is something that they need to consider, but also, you know, together with everything else. So what do you want to get out of a fellowship? And we talked already about some of the clinical aspects, but also how you want to be treated and, you know, all sorts of other things.
So when you applied, do they recognize all of your medical qualifications and UK exams, or did you have to do anything extra?
No, that's one of the other things. And I suppose it's one of the reasons that it is such a well paved road from the UK to Canada, because you don't really need to do much more. They recognize the FRCR just enough for you to do a fellowship. So you mm-hmm. can't practice independently, and you can't do locum work and extra shifts or things like that, because you are not eligible. So if you want to stay there and practice independently as a consultant, you do have to pass some exams.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, yes, it's a pretty automatic and straightforward process. And as I said, there's plenty of people to ask wherever you work in the UK. I think if you're ST4 or 5 in IR, just ask one of your colleagues. Somebody will have been to Canada or will know somebody who has. And it is, as I say, it's pretty straightforward.
And just to give people a flavour of what the interview was actually like, how difficult did you find it? What sort of questions were you asked?
It was very odd. It was very odd. First of all, it was not a medical interview. Like, especially in Toronto, all they asked me was about, you know, why do you want to come here and your kids and your wife? And, you know, it was a personality exam. It had almost nothing to do with radiology. And somebody actually told me afterwards. I just remembered. They told me during the interview. There was this lovely chap at UHN who was, he was, let's say, in the very, very late stage of his career. So he had seen probably more fellows than I have seen MRI breasts, certainly. And he said, basically, all I want to know from today is, can I stand working with you for a whole year? So that was it. That being said, when I went to when I went to Canada, I also interviewed at Montreal, because you know the flight was long, so I thought I'll shoot two birds with one stone. And I managed to organize it so that I had interviews the following day in Montreal. And so I went there, and So again, it was the same system. I traveled through during that day. I went to three different hospitals, and I think at least two, if not all three, I can't remember now, actually gave me sort of a viva. You know, they gave me cases and they asked me, how would you manage this? I mean, all very informal. It was one-on-one.
Yeah.
As I say, you go from hospital to hospital, and within each hospital, you try and meet as many people as you can. And you go from office to office to whoever is available. And some of them will be very informal, as in, oh, I'm just scrubbing in, walk with me for, you know, two and a half minutes, and that's it. Others will probably have made a bit of time. And as I said, they had some cases prepared, and they asked me, they gave me CT, kind of 2B style. Made things a bit more interesting. Yeah,
those little 2-minute chats you have walking with people down the corridor, does that form part of your assessment?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah, wow. And also, especially if they're like, you know, like the chap I mentioned earlier, their opinion will weigh very heavily. So you need to have all the tricks, you know, get your nice costume out. Somebody commented during the interview that I really like your costume. Your suit. I don't mean costume. I didn't have a clown or costume or anything. It was a nice suit.
Classy, Fabius.
Yeah. So, you know, get all of that right. You know, happy, enthusiastic, and, you know, hopefully so you'll know all
of
that. So you mentioned that you moved over there with wife and kids, which just seemed like a huge upheaval, particularly for a year. How challenging was that side of things?
So that was probably one of the most stressful things. But I am, as you know, and the listeners will tell from my accent, I'm already an immigrant in the UK. So I'm perhaps less scared of that, although last time I did it was when I moved to the UK more than a decade ago. So it's no small feat. I that's no doubt about that. And you know, I had to decide what to do with my two cars and the house and the mortgage. And where there's a will, there's a way. My wife asked for a sabbatical from work. The kids were fortunately small enough that they weren't in school yet, so that was very easy. And, you know, I managed to find a way for the house and the cars, and we just went. And again, my wife, who was very resourceful, managed to find a job there, actually,
wow,
a temporary job. And she was able to bring in some income, which is very important, apart from not getting bored.
Mm.
And, you know, the kids went one to nursery and one actually went to kind of school that the reception year.
Wow.
Because she was the right age. And it worked out. As I say, it was reasonably stressful. You have to find people to carry your boxes and not damage them, and then they damage them, and then there's a, we could do two episodes about my visits to the Toronto airport and custom security to try and rescue my coffee machine. Anyway, so there are, you know, like, but as I say, when there's a will, there's a way, and I think life is short and you should live it and do more than sofa Netflix work, sofa Netflix work, you know.
Yeah, you can always take the easy option, but obviously you've proved that if you really put your mind to it, then it's definitely achievable. And I'm sure you'd take it as worth it in the end, all of the upheaval.
I think so. And I don't know, I think you were going to ask me about money. And
So
there is that, and a lot of people should be worried about that hearing me talk, because as you know from the UK, nursery for small kids costs an arm and a leg. As I say, I was lucky that my daughter had just turned 4 and she was eligible to go to a state-funded primary school, which was free, and that was a big deal. And then we still had some issues because school finishes early and my wife got a job, but then that meant she couldn't look after the children. So we had to also find some sort of after school childcare, which costs money, and then rent, and then all the expenses in your in the UK, where depending on your circumstance, you may have more ties than others. As I said, I had a mortgage, I had two cars, I had, you know, a place at nursery that I had to discuss and, you know, keep or not keep. So, you know, there's your GMC fees, which you may not want to stop paying, because I looked into it and it's an absolute nightmare to come out of the GMC and then come back into the GMC. It's the paperwork is just huge. Royal College, etc., etc. So, yes, and the pay in Canada is not that generous. So the reality is, if you are alone, you should be fine. If you are alone with a partner, you should be okay-ish, if the partner can work especially. If you are with a partner and with small children and with a mortgage like me, you should be prepared to spend some money of your own. And again, you know, people's view will differ and circumstances, but in my view, it was an investment in my own career and my own future. And money, you can always make more money.
Yeah, you can't make experiences.
So how did the salary compare to, like, you know, training grades in the UK? Was it kind of equivalent of what you were earning as a senior radiology trainee, or was it more like F2 or something?
Yeah, it was more like F2, actually. Okay. But bear in mind, Canadian dollars are much less powerful than the pound. So if you do like for like, if you transform it into pounds, yes, it's about F2-ish level or ST2 or something like that. But in purchase power, it was probably a bit higher than that. So again, it matters, I suppose, what you leave behind in the UK. Because my mortgage was still in pounds. It was not interested in the fact that I had gone to Canada. So, but that's why I said, if you're on your own, so you get, you tend to get about $4,500. And that's a month. Yeah. And that's not bad. It is only bad if you live in downtown Toronto and have small kids to send to nursery, in which case it will barely cover.
And that was you.
That was me. Yeah.
So.
Marry well, whether you're a man or a woman, marry well. That's my advice.
So on a day-to-day basis, what was a typical week like on your fellowship?
That's a good question. So, you know, people think that doctors in North America earn more money than us in the UK. They should think that because it's absolutely true. But they also work more. I think we should recognize they do work more. The typical day would be that I would leave home at 10 to 7, get on the shuttle that would nicely pick me up from downtown and take me to Sunnybrook in about half an hour. So I was on the shop floor at 7:25 usually, and I would finish my first port insertion by 8:45 usually, something like that, or 8:30. You run the department. That's how it worked. There was another, I had another co-fellow, fortunately, to share my grief with and a laugh and, you know, exchange experiences. We would both start at 7:30, go through the list, consent everyone, mark what needed marking, you know, prescribe what needed prescribing, review imaging, and then start work. And we would tend to finish on the best days. We would take the shuttle again around 5:45. That was the optimal day. More often than that, it would be 6:30, and not unusual, probably 2 days a week, it would be the 7:00 shuttle, or we would miss the last shuttle and we would need to take something else. So roughly a 10-hour day every day, and the intensity of the work, it cannot be understated. They are like a machine. The department was like a machine. The wheels behind it, the radiographers and the nurses, they were like an Audi. They were like a German machine. And I would actually have to stop them from bringing patients in the room so quickly. You would come out of 3-hour TACE, you know, absolutely exhausted, sit down, and before you manage to get your lead off, somebody would come and would say, patient's ready in 92. And I'd be like, what patient? Oh, there's a line or something, you know. Absolutely, it's a well-oiled machine. And that's why people go to Canada, I think, especially for a procedural-based specialty like this, because you get your numbers. You get your numbers. So actually, now that I've mentioned it, I should probably say, because people like numbers, don't they? In my ST6 year, I had the best of intentions. I really did. And I think I managed to squeeze close to 500 cases. In Canada, I had 1,100, roughly. Wow. And of course, a lot of those, you know, there was like over 100 nephrostomy exchanges or something. So don't imagine it was just saving life after life. But that is important for somebody who needs to get their wire and catheter skills. So, I don't know, their bedside manner skills, whatever.
That really puts you ahead of someone who just does ST6 and then go straight into a consultant job. You can't
I like to think so, but yeah. I'm probably not the person to ask about that.
It's like you've done ST6 three times. If you do 500 and then you do 1,000 in another year, it's like you've done 3 years worth of ST6.
Good point, I suppose so.
And you said you did nephrostomy exchanges, but the general work mix, was it similar to the UK, or are they doing different cases, more advanced?
Well,
stuff?
Again, that depends where you want to go. So if you go to UHN in Toronto, for instance, they pretty much do everything under the sun, right? And hardcore stuff like complex procedures in almost every field of IR. I went to Sunnybrook, which is a large trauma center and large oncology center. So the vast majority of the work was IO, was TACE, actually. They didn't do any Y90, as it's called, or CERT, as we call it, for financial reasons.
Can you just explain what CERT is for our listeners and myself?
Sorry, yeah. So you know TACE is transarterial chemoembolization, generally almost exclusively for liver disease, liver cancers, or liver metastases. And Y90 or CERT is almost the same procedure in many aspects, but instead of shooting the tumor with beads coated in chemotherapy, you shoot them with radioactive beads.
Right.
And that is like internal, you know, like internal radiation, basically. It's like brachytherapy,
IR
that's the word.
Brachytherapy, yeah.
Correct, yeah. That's what is selective internal radiotherapy.
Okay.
And they use yttrium-90, which is why in North America they call it Y90, because, you know, they like simple words like that. So, but that's expensive. And anyway, it's a long conversation about that.
Mm-hmm.
So my work was almost exclusively cancer patients, a lot of central venous access port insertions for chemotherapy, a lot of TACE, some ablation of mostly liver tumors, sometimes kidney, a lot of gastrostomies, many different types of gastrostomies we did, again, for cancer patients. And then, of course, the usual, you know, kidney work, ureter stenting, some mm-hmm. of them quite interesting because, you know, complex surgery, they always nip the ureter a little bit, and then you have to find a way back into the bladder and things like that. There was some fistula work, but not as much as we do in the UK, simply because Canada has a far larger prevalence of dialysis via tunneled lines than we do in the UK. And which is why actually dialysis line related work was much more of a larger part of the day's work.
Right.
What else did we do? And then a few special things, I guess, you know, like there was one of my staff there, staff means consultant. they were very famous for adrenal vein sampling, for instance, and we used to do quite a few of those. And then they did a lot of fibroids, and they did them as day cases, which is something quite spectacular. And anyone who knows anything about fibroids knows that is the golden chalice that we all strive to do to compete with the gynecologists, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
So they had a very successful UAE program with day cases and a lot to learn about how to manage patients both pre and post-op. And again, this brings me back to my point at the beginning about the little things. Once you take the catheter out and you plug the hole in the artery and you pat yourself on the back that you're amazing, then it's all the management of the patient, you know, the pain, the complications, the follow-up, the and even the actual how to manage the person that is the patient. Because I do think there is a skill there if you want. Not, and I'm not saying that in a defensive way, you know, so they don't sue you, but for patient satisfaction, which is ultimately what you're aiming for, especially for a procedure like fibroid embolization.
Yeah. What was the relationship like between the IR guys and like the vascular surgeons over there? Are there still the same tensions, which not necessarily tensions, I don't want to play up the turf war, but were there any issues there?
I think it is very varied, just like it is in the UK. So, for instance, in Liverpool, we have a good collaboration. In other places, they have even better, and in other places, they have worse. In our particular case, in Sunnybrook, there had been a complete divorce. So I did something like one arterial case, peripheral vascular work. Everything else was being done by the surgeons. But further down in the city, I think at UHN, they did do vascular work that was mostly led by IR, I think, or it was certainly more of a collaborative approach. So again, it differs a lot, but that's the same as it is within the UK.
Yeah.
So again, find out what you want to get from your fellowship, and choose the correct place for that.
Did you feel like your training in the UK prepared you for what was expected of you when you started the fellowship?
I think so, because of how it ended. So the feedback that I received, I suppose, at the end of the fellowship was, let's just say positive without...
blowing your own trumpet, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. and after probably about, I don't know, 6 weeks or so there, I worked independently for, you know, most straightforward procedures, and then the consultant would come and help and actually be in the room scrubbed for, I don't know, let's say the embolization part of a TACE or those sort of things where you can, and some of that was depended on who the staff was and their own experience and nightmares from previous fellows, I think. So there's always that, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think I was well prepared.
And how well are the IR departments equipped there compared to the UK?
You know what? You would expect me to say, "Oh my God, it's North America! It's wonderful." Yeah. It wasn't.
Question.
No, okay. but maybe because we don't realize, I didn't realize that there is actually a huge difference between the States and Canada.
Mm.
There's a very big difference. Canada's system is pretty much free. It's more like the NHS. I mean, I don't fully understand the intricacies of how money works through that system, but it's certainly less generous than the UK. And there was one of the shocking things was, especially at the beginning, until you get used to it, that you don't spend money out the window, throw money out the window, like I think we often do without thinking too much. So, you know, putting $10,000 of stents in a patient who's got 3 weeks to live is, let's say, frowned upon. Whereas in my training throughout the UK, I never really questioned that. And Viabonds are given out as lollies, despite the fact that each one of them costs, I don't know, over £1,000 or something like that. You know, I've used in the UK, I've used now twice a Swift Ninja microcatheter that costs something like £1,200, which in Canadian dollars is close to 2,000. You would not find that in a, except, I mean, maybe you would find it in maybe at UHN, although I'm not convinced. But I'm sure there is a department somewhere in Canada that has stuff like that, but it would be hard to find.
Yeah.
So in terms of disposable equipment, they were a bit more conscious of the fact that all of this costs a lot of money.
Yeah.
In terms of infrastructure, like the actual, you know, equipment fixed to the wall, the Sunnybrook wasn't spectacular. It was probably similar to what we have in Liverpool, in the old hospital. Other places, like at UHN where I went, you know, they had a CT scanner in one of the rooms, for instance, which was very cool. But the whole place looked quite run down, actually. But in Montreal, for instance, where I went, one of the hospitals had just been built like 2 years ago. And it was, you know, it was a pleasure to walk into, let alone work. Everything was brand new. So overall, I think it's actually very similar to the UK. It depends where you want to work. And if you're lucky and they have just built a hospital, then that's amazing. But otherwise.
Yeah. So just reflecting back on your time in Canada now, is it something that you would recommend to other IR trainees?
The answer to that is a big fat yes. Mm-hmm. And when I say that, I am also taking into account the fact that it was not ruined, but certainly the, you know, some of the value of it was taken away by COVID, which hit halfway through, and it meant some procedures were no longer being done, like fibroid embolizations. And of course, from a social point of view, it was a disaster. And actually, I had saved 2 of the 4 weeks of annual leave I had to go visit the other coast, Vancouver and the likes. And I had saved that for the summer before I came back home. And clearly we couldn't do that. So I ended up spending the 2 weeks I had in lockdown and not visit half the things I wanted to. So from that point of view, it was disappointing. But from a work point of view, I think it is a fantastic experience. I think not only for what I mentioned, you know, procedure numbers and getting your skills up, but also to see how other departments work, how other healthcare system work, interaction with other clinicians, you know, the way they run their MDTs, and of course, and then, you know, all that aside, the life experience for you, for your children, for your wife or husband. My wife absolutely loved it, despite the fact that she was stuck indoors for 6 months with two kids under five. Yes, definitely go for it.
And do you have any advice or tips for anyone who's applying for IR fellowships in general?
I think what I kept saying is find out why you want to go, because you don't want to be disappointed, because you can be. And I have heard of cases where you can be disappointed and fellows who have gone home after 2 months for various reasons. So, they call them duds, because sometimes they come and it turns out that actually they were good only on paper. But there is that. But also you can be disappointed by what you actually get to do there. So, you know, if you want to do vascular intervention, definitely don't do the fellowship that I did. But if you want to do IO, then definitely do. Or if you just want to get your skills up in various things, you know, St. Mike's in Toronto is probably the best place to go. So find out what you want to get out of it and find the correct fellowship, be it in Canada or anywhere else. Personally, I would recommend you go outside the UK to add value to whatever it is you're going to learn, because things are done in a certain way, I started to realize, and England is not, especially England, is not that big. So chances are you can't go far enough to learn a new way to skin the cat. But if you go all the way to Canada, you probably will.
Skin the moose.
Or skin. Yes. So, and as I said, it looks daunting, especially with the family. But as I've just proven, it can be done. You just have to have the will.
Great. Okay, so I think we've pretty much covered everything there. It's a bit of a whistle-stop tour, but hopefully our listeners will have a flavour of what to expect if they want to do something similar. So thank you very much, Flavius, for kicking us off with our fellowship series and for taking the time out of your sort of day. The fact you've only been interrupted once, so you're quite busy, but not as busy as you maybe say you are. thanks a lot.
You got me. Yeah, well, thank you very much for the opportunity, and I hope it helps somebody. And you're doing a very good job. I enjoy your podcast. So
thank you.
Keep going, guys. All right.
So thanks for listening, guys. We'll be back next month with another episode. And in the meantime, you can catch all of our previous episodes on all the major podcast platforms and at anchor.fm/radcast. And for more updates, check out our social media channels, and we can be found at Radcast Academy on Twitter and Instagram. Bye.
Goodbye.